Yeah, I thought we should take the hour and split it between Carlo Baragni, who actually I was lucky enough to have him as a graduate student many years ago. And I thought what we would do is split the hour up, and I would speak for approximately 20 or 25 minutes and then turn things over to Carlo. But what I wanted to do is just give you a sort of a background idea of what the turbulence problem really is. Turbulence is essentially the random motion of fluids that comes at high velocities or high Reynolds numbers. To give you a few classical examples from sort of 1920s literature, here is a picture of a cylinder and a relatively low-speed flow over it. You can see a couple of trailing vortices have been formed behind the cylinder. But if you increase the flow rate, the two vortices become completely turbulent, and you get this turbulent wake. The classic way in the lab to make turbulence, which is approximately what you really want, is you can't solve the turbulence problem in general. There's no such thing. So what you try to do is do something, as simple as you can in a lab. And the classic way of making a homogeneous turbulence is simply blow air or water through a grid. And let's see, why don't I get a, yeah, here we go. Yeah, here's a grid, and this happens to be a water tunnel, but it could be a wind tunnel as well. And also, if you don't want to have a fan blowing this water along, you can oscillate the grid. I just published a paper last week in PhysRevE on the flow behind an oscillating grid. So, and then here is the kind of stuff behind the airplane wing when you're flying here for a conference. Now, the flow of water and air, of course, is governed by classical mechanics. And the water, of course, is the simplest because it's incompressible. And so what Carlo and I would like to talk about is how's the turbulence modified if water is replaced by a superfluid? How does, in particular, how does quantum turbulence differ from classical turbulence? You'd think a tremendous amount, but you'd be wrong. So the idea of turbulence is exemplified by the tap in your kitchen. If you turn the water just barely on, you'll get a beautiful laminar jet coming out of the tap. But if you open the tap wide, you get a turbulent mess following it. So classical turbulence is usually thought of as a motion of eddies. And the idea of eddies, we're fond of saying, was invented by the 15th century artist Leonardo da Vinci. But what people forget is Da Vinci was a military engineer, and he was in charge of waterworks and things like that. And he made these sketches of, I think I'll go back. Yeah, he made these sketches of water flowing through a weir. And you can see that he has done a very faithful job of recognizing that there are eddies in this flow. Let's see, where are we here? Oh, yeah, that there are distinct eddies in this particular flow. And so for that reason, we say that our field is more than 500 years old. Anyhow, eddies can be small, they can be big, they can be weak, they can be strong. It's a mess. Here, for instance, is a picture of a classic tornado, which is certainly one big vortex. Here is a cyclone approaching a landfall. Beautiful picture taken from the air. And we have to describe what's going on somehow by the Navier-Stokes equation. And this is the Navier-Stokes equation. And essentially, it has the acceleration, it has a nonlinear term, the square of the velocity, it has a pressure gradient term, and it has a dissipation term. And the new is the kinematic viscosity, it's a viscosity divided by the density, it has dimensions square centimeters per second. And the ratio of this term to this term is called the Reynolds number. And generally speaking, in engineering circles, people define, you can define the Reynolds numbers in lots of ways, unfortunately. But generally, you take some characteristic length, some characteristic velocity, and normalize it by the kinematic viscosity. So at very high Reynolds number, if you're really pushing the flow, you're essentially not going to get any dissipation at all due to viscous effects. The question starting really by the 1890s was, how the heck do you understand the what's going on in a turbulent flow at high Reynolds numbers? Well, the most important idea was really what's called the Richardson cascade. And his idea was that at some scale, for instance, given, say, the largest scale in the experiment, that would be the scale at which energy is put into the fluid. And Richardson's idea was that the nonlinear U dot grad U term would cause those eddies to break up into smaller eddies and still smaller eddies. And the idea is there's no dissipation involved in that transfer. And that, in fact, you don't get any dissipation until the Reynolds number is getting down of order one, in which case viscosity takes over and kills the flow. So they... So that's the Richardson cascade, and the Kolmogorov idea was to consider the turbulence as being homogeneous and isotropic in space. And the spectral energy density, that's the amount of energy in a given wavelength, is called E of K. And of course, epsilon is the energy dissipated per unit mass. These units are quite peculiar, and nu is the kinematic viscosity. Now, if the Reynolds number is large enough when you begin, then viscosity doesn't matter, and energy should depend on the wave number k, the dissipation epsilon, and the kinematic viscosity nu. But if your a lot of your flow is in it really at quite high Reynolds numbers, then you can neglect dissipation altogether, and you end up with the spectral energy density being proportional to the dissipation to the two-thirds and the wave number to the five-thirds. And the that prediction was also made independently by von Weizsäcker when he was locked up after the war in an English castle as a scientific prisoner of war, and also by my advisor, Lars Ansager, who didn't know about either of the other derivations. So when he would talk about it, he'd say, for good measure, he says, I derived it myself. So then the question was, is the idea right? And so the experimental community, mostly people at Cambridge, tried all sorts of wind tunnel experiments and so on, but they all turned out to be very, very hard to do. And in my opinion, the best experiment that has ever been done in classical turbulence was done here in Canada at UBC by Bob Stewart, who is a graduate student of G.I. Taylor's group in Cambridge. And so the cos in A is something of order one or one and a half. And so the way that they did this, this is a rather busy slide. I apologize for that. But the thing to look at is the is this particular curve. This is the spectral energy density where the input scale is at a wave number, however you normalize it, of order one, and you get most of the energy put in up here. It decays until finally viscosity takes over, and at a very short wavelengths, viscosity takes over and kills the eddies altogether. But if the so-called inertial subrange, that's this part here, which is independent of viscosity, it has a slope of five-thirds. And of course, the big goal is to say, how can you find that experimentally? Well, I think this Canadian experiment is very much underappreciated, and I've never heard anybody talk about it at a conference in my life. But here's what actually happened. If you go to the straits between British Columbia and Vancouver Island, here's Vancouver Island. I don't know if I'll ever learn to run this laser. Here's Vancouver Island, and North America would be over there. And there's an island here called Quadra Island, and there's a channel called a tidal channel running between Vancouver Island and this Quadra Island. And it's long enough that the phase of the tides between the input and the output of this tidal channel is enough to drive a very vigorous flow. In fact, it has a Reynolds number of 40 million. And so these UBC guys decided that that was the place to do an experiment looking for the Kolmogorov spectrum. And they worked roughly at station four here, which is about the narrowest part of this tidal channel. As a matter of fact, my oceanographic students tell me that if you have a boat and that tidal thing is being driven at full bore, you can't get through it all. So it's really barreling through there. And so they decided to build Canadian Navy research station on the West Coast. So they got hold of this ship from the Oceanographic Institute, and they towed a Vortex probe at the end of a long cable. And I can show you a photograph of that probe. It was a very, very difficult experiment. For one thing, electronics was relatively crude in those days. I mean, the only way to store stuff was on magnetic tape. And of course, your boat is doing this, and all the other ships that are coming down the other way in the channel are scared out of their wits when they see you bouncing around trying to take measurements. So I think it was an absolute tour de force that they were able to do this experiment at all. But by golly, here is the first really successful attempt at getting the five-thirds law. That solid line is the five-thirds law. And here's where viscosity takes over. This is wave number, and this is spectral energy. And you can see that over quite a few orders of magnitude, the inertial subrange is indeed exactly as Kolmogorov predicted. I thought it was one of the most exciting experiments I've ever heard about, but it must have been fantastically difficult. So the topic today is, what is quantum turbulence, and why bother studying it? Well, there's two superfluids that could be used and have been used very extensively. Helium-2 is, of course, just the superfluid phase of isotope helium-4, But isotope 3B, helium 3B, is also a superfluid, but you've got to work it in milli and even microdegree temperatures to do these experiments. So that's a tour de force by itself to be able to get that kind of temperature and do an actual dynamic experiment. And generally speaking, as I'll elucidate in a little more detail in a few minutes, the superfluids really have normal fluid, which has viscosity, and superfluid, which has no viscosity, intermixed in a two-fluid theory. But in principle, if you do an experiment, you could very, very easily, in trying to do a superfluid experiment, you could accidentally make the normal fluid turbulent too. And so you're in a minefield of choices. And that makes this field very, very difficult. Of course, the circulation around a superfluid vortex is strictly quantized. That's something that Ansager was the first to announce, followed shortly by Dick Feynman. And I'm just going to talk about helium isotope 4 because that's the subject I know the most about. Here's a phase diagram for helium 4, and you have when you cool down a doer of a liquid helium transfer from your liquefier, and the critical point's about 5.2 degrees Kelvin, and as you pump on it, it goes down along the saturated vapor curve and hits something we call a lambda transition, where all sorts of discontinuities occur. And in a region underneath, most of us just work at the saturated vapor pressure, because that's the simplest experimental rig you can do, and there's no disadvantages I can think of. I've never done an experiment where I had to do this sort of stuff. A couple of experiments show you there's something very strange about helium too, that is helium below the lambda transition. The first is if you connect two reservoirs by what's called a super leak, a very, very narrow channel, so narrow that the normal fluid responds very, very slowly to a pressure gradient, then you'll find that the warmer tank has a greater hydrodynamic head than the cooler tank. So this is at temperature T. And the next one is temperature T plus delta T. And the level here is higher than the level here, and that's described by the two fluid equations of motion. In fact, that's the equation that governs the amount of pressure difference you're going to get with a temperature difference delta T, and S is the entropy. So there are really two kinds of fundamental experiments. This is a very crude idea of an experiment first done by Kapitsa in Moscow, I think. And he has what we call a super leak at the bottom. It's two ground glass plates held together by strong springs. So the mean spacing in there is really just short of being completely tight. And if you dip that under the fluid and raise it to where it's showing now, the rate of emptying of that reservoir is high enough that the viscosity certainly has to be less than 10 to the minus 11 poise. And water's, you know, something like 10 to the minus 2. And on the other hand, here's an experiment first done at Toronto in the early 30s or late 20s. It was a disc suspended by a torsion fiber, and the Toronto people found that if you turn that bottom disc say around one complete rotation and let it go, it decays at a quite modest rate. And the viscosity was something of the order of 10 micropoise. So here you've got the same fluid acting in two different ways. And that challenge was taken up by the theoretical community, in particular Lalo Tietze, who just died a couple of years ago at 101 years old. And he and I were pretty good friends, I've often talked to him about his big discovery. He decided that those two experiments justified the idea of having the total density composed of normal fluid density, rho n, and superfluid density, rho s, and two velocity fields. And he proposed then that separation that I just described. And in fact, he had an equation for the superfluid, the top equation, and an equation for the normal fluid, the bottom equation. And he had a fountain pressure term, which describes what happens under a temperature difference. This is the same thing you use in the Navier-Stokes equation for pressure gradients, but he had two velocity fields. And the first thing that popped out was that there should be two velocities of sound. And the first one was ordinary sound, pressure fluctuations, density fluctuations, if you will. And he was able to predict, actually with some help from Landau's group, he was able to describe, here's the lambda transition, this is helium 1, this is helium 2. And then a very peculiar thing he named second sound. Incidentally, Tietze was one of the original five Landau students that knew the theoretical minimum. So anyhow, the second sound was predicted. Lalo was running around the world talking to experimentalists, trying to have them look for onde de temperature. And so the experimental community knew they were supposed to find some kind of temperature wave, but they sure didn't know how to generate it or detect it. And that's quite a story in itself. Anyhow, both Onsager and Feynman, but certainly Onsager first, predicted that circulation in a superfluid would be strictly quantized. And the reason, of course, was Bose-Einstein condensation in helium 2. And in particular, Feynman predicted that if you set a cylinder into steady rotation, that you would get an array of quantized vortex lines. And when I learned about that, I had a graduate student called Klaus Schwartz, and he and I decided that we would make vortex rings, which had just been discovered by Rayfield and Reif at Berkeley, and fire those vortex lines horizontally against a rotating bucket of helium that presumably had these line vortices. And what we discovered is there was a scattering cross-section, and by golly, it turned out to be more or less exactly the diameter of the ring. And so that indicated to us that if the ring and the line touched, there would be a strong interaction. And that's something that Dick Feynman had already been telling people, is that what was really going to happen is what happened when two opposite circulations piece of line approached. There would be a reconnection. And that's what Carlo will be talking about. So that was Feynman's original thing. Schwartz converted himself into a theoretical physicist and started to write code that he could simulate vortex flow. And he worked the rest of his professional life on this problem. And this slide came relatively late in his career. I think he was at IBM. But here is the, he's taken the, this flow goes through the front of this slice and out the back. And he's seeded the flow with four or five vortex rings. And now, as you go from here to here to here to here to here to here, the tangle is developing more into more and more density. And these computer simulations have become now very, very sophisticated. And that's why I'm glad we have Carlo here to talk a little bit about how that all goes. Because it allows us to do things which you can't do by experiment. But you can ask questions and answer them by these simulations. So I'll end up by saying, how about the Kolmogorov spectrum in a quantum turbulent flow? And the answer here was a real bell ringer, because it was done in Paris by Patrick Tabley at ENS. And the experiment, instead of being the size of a tidal channel, is something the size of your fist. So it's a rather different scale. What he had was two oppositely rotating blades called two and two on this little diagram. He had a Peter tube called three, which would sample the fluctuations. And he then succeeded in measuring the Kolmogorov spectrum. And so the first thing he did was try the experiment above the lambda transition. And so he got a beautiful Kolmogorov spectrum at a temperature just above 2.17 is the lambda transition. So this is 2.3. He's got a beautiful Kolmogorov spectrum, and the resolution is about the same as the experiment in the Straits of Georgia. But the real surprise was he went right under the lambda transition, where there's still a lot of normal fluid, but now some superfluid, and there was no change. And finally, he went down to 1.4 degrees Kelvin, which is more than 90% superfluid, and there's still no change. So that was a knockout of a result. I've never seen anything that was so unexpected in most of my professional career. And so the question is, why in heck should a quantum fluid have a classical Kolmogorov spectrum? And so I think what I'll do is break off here and let Carlo take over, give you some ideas.
The temperature increases when the temperature is lower, or is that
stable? Yeah, the temperatures, I'll go back. Oh, here we are. Yeah, this is 2.3 degrees. This is 2.08 degrees. The lambda transition is 2.176. And this is 1.4 degrees, where you've got about 96% superfluid. Yeah, just the change in temperature. Well, Carlo, I think I should turn over to you. Oh, yes, you got a mic. Sorry.
No, that's okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me here. So I would like to show this slide just to name my collaborators. I am Carlo Barenghi at Newcastle University in England in the mathematics department. And we have a formal collaboration with Durham called the Joint Quantum Center. So Russ has told you about superfluid helium and vortex lines. So I'm skipping some slides. So the essence of the problem is that we have a macroscopic wave function with an amplitude and a phase. And the vortex line is some kind of topological defect, a line defect, which is really a hole in the condensate, in the superfluid component, around which the phase changes by 2 pi. So this cartoon describes schematically a vortex line in helium, a homogeneous superfluid, a hole, and the change of the phase around it. Now, people study vortices and also turbulence in atomic condensates. They are very different in the sense that they're small systems, they're not homogeneous. So our vortex is a hole with circulation, but in some kind of non-uniform profile, and you see a typical picture at the right-hand side, that small dot is the hole, which represents the vortex line. Now, vortex lines and their properties are really old objects of fluid mechanics. In fact, here I have listed the names of some people like Helmholtz, Kelvin, Tate, Rankine, and J.J. Thomson. They developed many of the ideas which we're still using. For example, the idea of a vortex ring, Kelvin waves, which are helical perturbations along a vortex, vortex knots, etc. And from these very early times of the mid-1800s, we see that there were vortices were already thought as possible models, attractive models for some kind of fundamental physics, like elementary particles, simply because they're stable topological defects. We have a superfluid, there is no viscous dissipation, and essentially the defect is locked by the phase, and if it does not decay, these structures remain. They're persistent. So nowadays we can visualize individual vortices very well. I have here a list of pictures from Berkeley's vortex lattice seen from above, which is essentially these dots, each dot representing a vortex line, to experiments in condensates. This is a picture, experimental picture taken at MIT, to visualization of the vortex lattice from the side, experiments done in Maryland, for example. Now we come to turbulence. So it's very easy to generate to stir turbulence in superfluid helium or in atomic condensates, many simple ways. You just use vibrating grids, forks, wires, heat flows. You can shake the trap of your atomic gases, and the vortices become tangled up. And this is a snapshot which represents turbulence, say, in liquid helium, and this will be in atomic condensates. So these are numerical simulations which we have done. You see the major difference. For superfluid helium, we do simulations in periodic boxes because the system is large and homogeneous. We do very realistic simulations for condensates, and the system is small. So what I mean is that the hollow of the vortex, of each vortex, is actually a significant fraction of the size of the system. Now, I would like to give you some insight about what is turbulence, what is quantum turbulence. So let me play this movie. So we have a periodic box in which we inject vortex rings. There is a bit of dissipation, so there is a bit of decay. And you see that the vortices wave. They make Kelvin waves. They interact, they reconnect, and we're pumping energy into the system until some statistical steady state is reached, which is actually quantum turbulence. Now, in this case, this is an example of vortex dynamics. So we assume that the vorticity is concentrated to lines of infinitesimal thickness. Essentially, it is nothing but the Euler equation for singularities to which we add the assumption of reconnections. So it's pure Euler dynamics plus reconnections. Reconnections, I stress, is totally outside the context of Euler. So I want to stress that this is somehow the skeleton of turbulence, because what is shown here is only the axis of the vortices, What matters is the flow around this axis, which is potential, it is inviscid, and it has the same strength, the quantum of circulation discovered by Onsager. Just to give you some feeling for the motion of vortices, I want to recall this problem, which was quite fun to do. The waves along vortices were described fully by Lord Kelvin in 1880. He recovered the dispersion relation, the angle of frequency versus the wave number, but it took more than a century to notice that a vortex ring, which is a typical object which can be realized in the laboratory, once there are waves, goes much slower. And I have here another animation to show you this effect. So what you see is a vortex ring. The blue object on the left, which is traveling at constant velocity. In green, what is shown is a vortex ring with waves, which propagate, and you see that it goes much slower. And when the amplitude of the waves is much larger, the vortex actually goes backwards. So when you do these numerical experiments, you have to be careful, because if you make the amplitude too large, then the structure falls apart because it self-reconnects, okay?
What are the initial conditions there?
They
all start off the same?
They start at this coordinate, and the point is that they move at very different speeds.
Well, I see that, but are they all starting off with momentum upward? Or
yeah,
upward?
Correct.
So it's just big one and it goes backwards.
So it's the same ring, the same radius, average radius, and here we have helical waves of small amplitude on top, and here we have large waves.
So I understand that it's the up down that I'm trying to get. So the equations of motion are first
order, so once you specify the shape,
that is it.
There's no initial condition for velocity.
Oh, okay.
The vortex propagates. Due to the geometry, the equation of motion is essentially Euler, which means the Biot-Savart law. In electromagnetism, the Biot-Savart law gives you the magnetic field generated by current. In the context of Euler dynamics, it will give you the velocity generated by a geometry. So we simply give the geometry, no more. So this is an unusual effect, it's very surprising, but it essentially, I hope it will convince you that vortices somehow have...
What distinguishes from the up? Why the blue is moving up, not down? What's the difference between up and down?
Oh, the orientation, remember, the vortex is an oriented line. Vorticity is oriented because the flow has a particular direction. That's right. It's not, there is a flow around the axis. Okay, other structures which we can study are knots. So we go up in complexity, and I'm very keen on these things because the topology of turbulence is really a mystery, and it's also very difficult to define in the context of ordinary fluids because the vorticity is continuous. So there are changes of the topology, but it is changes in a continuous field. Once your vorticity is discrete, like in this case, then you can actually do some actual computations, numerical experiments, try out some ideas. So for example, we studied the stability of simple knotted structures like trefoils, coils, etc. And this topic has become quite important nowadays because of the experiments at Chicago by William Irvine, who managed to reproduce in a predictable, reproducible manner given vortex structures like this trefoil knot. In fact, if we take a snapshot of quantum turbulence at a fixed time and look at the geometry of the vortex lines, you discover amazing knotted structure. So this picture was given to me by Bob Schrein, who wrote a famous piece of software to study the knottiness of molecules, DNA, and filamentary objects. And he recovered, he was not able to undo it. Could not even name it, of course. So, of course, reconnections will destroy the structure, but of course, they will also create more structures. So the good question is, on the average, which kind of topology is there in the turbulence? And that is totally an open question. So I mentioned reconnections, and Russ said that Feynman was the first to envisage this idea that quantum vortices can come together and change the topology. Now, this now is observed experimentally. And that was done a few years ago in Maryland, and they gave me a little movie, which I would like to show because it is, I think, fantastic. So what you see here is liquid helium, or better, snowballs of hydrogen in liquid helium, about 1 micron size, visualized by a laser beam. And so these dots are freely moving snowballs. And occasionally we see that there is like a line of dots. This is a quantized vortex, which has trapped some snowballs, so it's visible. There is not much focal depth here. It's small parallelepiped, which is the area of visualization. And occasionally in this movie, you will see actually a vortex line, two vortex lines coming together and reconnecting with a very sharp movement. You see here? There was another one there. So nowadays, we can see individual vortex reconnections. These are the fundamental events which really change the topology of turbulence. Now, reconnection, yes?
In your simulations, is it feasible to measure the linking number?
Yes, it is feasible. We have tried to do it. We actually studied essentially the transient, how the topology changes as the energy increases, because we are essentially starting up the turbulence. The good question is, what is the property of steady, what is the average topology of steady turbulence? How does it scale with the Reynolds number? These are questions which I would like to answer, and I'm seeking funds for that. Okay. So I said reconnection. Reconnections are a very general phenomenon of continuous classical mechanics. So, for example, you must have seen trailing vortices following the tips of the wings of an airplane. And if you look behind, waves become unstable. This is the so-called Crow instability. Then reconnections will make vortex rings. Reconnections exist in magnetohydrodynamics. So a good example is what happens after a large solar loop. Reconnections are computed by solving the Navier-Stokes equation. In this calculation, you see regions of intense vorticity marked in orange and blue, the two different positive and negative, and you see two anti-parallel vortices coming together, and they change the topology, and notice the formation of this bridge, this small filament. Because what I want to show you now is reconnections of quantum vortices. So these are numerical simulations based on the Gross-Peterski equation, a nonlinear Schrodinger equation. Here it is. So let me run it again and tell you what is visible here. So we have two anti-parallel vortices. I'm plotting isodensity contours. The vortices come together. They're almost reconnecting there. And then they snap. There is a reconnection. So notice the Kelvin waves, these helical waves, which are actually launched and move energy to infinity. Kelvin waves essentially triggered by the reconnection event, and the amplitude gets so large that in this particular example, we generate vortex rings. You see the waves, these modulations. Now things can get rather interesting if the structures which reconnect are slightly more complex than simply two vortices. So I'm going to say later that we think that there are lots of bundles of vortices in quantum turbulence. So let's see when bundles come together. Okay? So here we have two bundles. In each bundle, the vortices are parallel. So that is why they rotate. You see the vortices rotating. The bundles interact. Reconnections take place. And notice the large amount of Kelvin waves, these helical disturbances, which are propagated. Notice also vortex loops, which are generated and fly all over. And notice also this bridge of only two vortices, which is formed between the reconnecting bundles. And that is amazing, because somehow it shows that our quantum vortices attempt to reproduce features which we see when we studied in a Navier-Stokes equation for ordinary fluids. Okay, but there is another feature of reconnection which is important, and it is the fact that sound is radiated at reconnection. In fact, in general, when we have a Kelvin wave of high wave numbers, so very short wavelengths, sound is radiated. When experiments of turbulence in liquid helium were done first in the early 2000 at very, very low temperatures, that was done in Lancaster first, it was noticed that the turbulence decays very quickly, actually. And that was very unexpected, because why should a superfluid motion die out without viscosity? So I think the answer is simply that kinetic energy gets turned into acoustic energy, into sound waves. And Kelvin waves are a good mechanism to generate sound, but also the connections. So, yes?
In the earlier picture, I saw some closed loops coming out.
Coming out?
Are they like rotons?
They're not, okay. Yeah, it would be nice to interpret those small loops as rotons. However, to be precise, these are numerical solutions of the nonlinear Schrödinger equation, the Gross-Pitesque equation for a Bose-Einstein condensate. If you look at the spectrum of excitations, it lacks the Roton branch. It is only a phonon branch, and then essentially particles. There is no Roton. Okay. However, if you modify the equation, you can get something which you can interpret as a Roton, and there is a connection between small vortex rings and some kind of solitons called the Roberts-Jones solitons. Okay, so going back to reconnections, I want to show you a reconnection of again, of two antiparallel vortices. Try this. So the usual reconnection of two antiparallel vortices. Okay, so you've seen this already, because now I want to add an ingredient. So I put a plane in the middle. And on this plane, I draw surfaces of the density. Remember that the vortex core is a hole. And what you see here, right after the reconnection, you see the vortex loop has reconnected, and we have like a U-shaped vortex here and there. You see this sound wave, which is launched and then goes to infinity. So energy is lost. The energy of the vortices is lost. The kinetic energy is lost. It has become sound, which is radiated out away to infinity. So that's why a superfluid turbulence decays even at very, very low temperatures. Okay. So Kelvin waves, the radiation of sound, but rapidly rotating vortices and reconnections are really the sinks, the acoustic sinks of our kinetic energy. Now, it's interesting also to notice that reconnections decrease the kinetic energy, because the other reconnections which we know about, reconnections in ordinary fluids, actually reduce the kinetic energy. They turn kinetic energy into heat, that is the effect of the viscosity of the fluid. And also, we get heating if we have to do with a plasma, because the loss of energy is simply caused by the finite electrical resistivity. So reconnections really seem to be associated in general in all fluid systems, either astrophysical or classical or quantum, to losses of energy. So there are some features here which are very, very generic. Okay, now I want to go back a bit to the idea of the Kolmogorov spectrum, which Russ Donnelly described. According to the experimental evidence, at the moment, it seems that we can make sense of two kinds of quantum turbulence. There is one kind which we can call semi-classical. It contains coherent structures. Most of the energy is at the large length scales, that is to say, the small wave numbers. The energy spectrum seems to be either the Kolmogorov spectrum, the k to the minus 5/3 law, or very similar to the Kolmogorov spectrum. it decays in a classical fashion. And I think the key experiments which show that were the experiment of Tabeling, which Donnelly mentioned a few minutes ago. That was in 1998. The turbulence generated by two counter-rotating blades, and also the turbulence generated by a taut grid, a grid which is suddenly moved across, into liquid helium. What was observed was the decay of this turbulence, which is purely classical, and that was a paper in 93, a few years earlier. But there is another form of turbulence which can be produced, which seems different. It seems to be featureless. It has different decay rates. It has a different spectrum. Most energy is at the mesoscales. And some people call it ultra-quantum. So other people use names. They call this turbulence Kolmogorov because it's similar to classical. And Vinen, after Joe Vinen, who experimentally determined the value of the quantum of circulation. So why there are two forms of turbulence, I do not know really. Is this solid information? Yes, but I would not bet a large amount of money on this. But that is the evidence.
What are the features of this quantum?
Well, I'm going to show in a moment. Basically, it is without features. Okay, it's a bit random. Random motion. We'll go to that. Okay, so first of all, the spectrum. So I'm showing results of numerical simulations done with the models which we have, the vortex filament model, essentially the Euler equation plus the reconnections, and the Gross-Pitaisky equation. So you see, well, the energy spectrum, we compute a velocity field, we Fourier transform it, we put together the energy, and essentially the energy spectrum gives us the density of the energy over the length scales. So for the ultra-quantum turbulence, you see a spectrum which decays like k to minus 1 at large wave numbers. The decay rate is t to the minus 1 half. And you see that essentially most of the energy, the spectrum peaks at the mesoscales. And these mesoscales, this broad peak, more or less corresponds to the typical distance between the vortices. For the semi-classical turbulence, the spectrum has essentially the Kolmogorov form. It's never actually, I must say, that we never get a precise k to minus 5/3, because the numerical simulations which we can do will never actually give very good minus 5/3, and that is also true in classical fluid mechanics when the Navier-Stokes equation is actually solved. So the best spectra are experimental spectra. And we have a different decay rate, okay? Now, what is the difference between these two turbulences? Well, why we get minus 5/3, first of all? The minus 5/3 law suggests to us, according to the ideas of Richardson and Kolmogorov and von Weizsäcker and other people, that energy is transferred from large scales to small scales. And a typical process which generates these small scales is vortex stretching. So, what is vortex stretching? Well, in classical fluid mechanics, you can take like a vortex tube and essentially stretch it. You make it thinner, and the rotation, that is to say, the vorticity will increase. You cannot do that for a quantum vortex, because quantum mechanical constraints will prevent you from doing that. The vortex tube, the core of the vortex, is fixed by quantum mechanics. However, if there is a bundle of vortices, then it's possible to bring the vortices together. And essentially, a stretching can exist at length scales larger than the size of the bundle. So let's look at this picture, which I'm sort of proud of. So it is a recent paper, relatively recent. So what we see here is the lines which represent a snapshot of a vortex tank. They've been color-coded. How do we do that? Well, essentially, what we did was to use the information of the orientation of the lines, that is to say, the orientation of the velocity field. When the lines are oriented together, there is vorticity there is some kind of coarse grain vorticity on length scales larger than the distance between the vortices, and there is a large scale motion around lines. So we color code the lines with the yellow or a light color. Okay? So this is the scale of the vorticity. So we can actually distinguish this snapshot, this configuration of vortices, into essentially two parts using some arbitrary threshold. And the threshold is typically the RMS, or something proportional to the RMS vorticity. The bundles, and what is not a bundle. So what we see here are these coherent regions where the vortices, for a brief time, because it's a metastable effect, the vortices come together, they are parallel, therefore they have a large-scale motion, which is the circulation around the bundle for a moment, and then the bundle gets destroyed and forms somewhere else and gets destroyed, etc. So metastable coherent structures come together. And the second part of the decomposition is this vortex configuration, which looks like random spatially. Indeed, if we take the spectrum of the two parts, we notice indeed the transition from the Kolmogorov law, -5/3, to the essentially individual vortex lines, which is k minus one. So this makes me to conclude that necessarily when we see in the experiments, on the numerical simulations, the Kolmogorov law, we have bundles, okay? However, I must say that there is not experiments in which individual bundles have been detected. That is still missing. It's not an easy task because the bundles appear in the flow and then they vanish. So you need to stick your probe in a location and hope that something will happen at the right time when you look. So this is still an open question. Yes?
Can you understand that k to the minus one from the random?
Yeah. Well, it's essentially k to minus one is the spectrum of a single line. Okay. Is the spectrum of a single line. Yeah. Okay, one more picture. The experiment of tabling has been repeated. I think the best examples at the moment, the best spectral moment are taken at Grenoble, at CNRS, where Philippe Roche and collaborators have built rather large superfluid wind tunnels. You see some experimental Kolmogorov spectrum here. And there's something else I want to add. If you look at what happens at very low temperatures, then there is a very interesting problem which appears. We've seen that the Kolmogorov spectrum arises from the Euler interaction of vortices. So we have these bundles which cause this Euler interaction. So let me represent the bundles. So as oriented sort of structures, the vortices are oriented, okay? So the bundle stretch creates smaller scales, etc. But what happens if we look at length scale, which is actually smaller than the typical distance between vortices? Then we're looking at individual vortex lines. And at very low temperatures, individual vortex lines can become very wiggly because there is no damping to prevent Kelvin waves from being generated. On the contrary, there is a cascade effect which makes Kelvin waves to interact nonlinearly and produce Kelvin waves which are shorter. So here we expect waves on individual vortices and a second cascade, which has been called the Kelvin wave cascade. So if we look at the spectrum of a wider range of length scales, we expect the Kolmogorov cascade, which is classical in nature, at large length scales. And the Kelvin wave cascade at much higher wave numbers. In the last few years, there have been competing theories of this Kelvin wave cascade. I think the issue has been settled, now we know what is the spectrum. But there is still a problem which is left, because the energy which comes down from the Kolmogorov cascade cannot actually go neatly through into the Kelvin wave cascade, according to some people, in particular Viktor Lvov and Sergei Nazarenko, who proposed this idea. So they predict that there is a bottleneck in energy spectrum between the two cascades. So we have some kind of double turbulence. The cutoff, if you want, between the two regions, the crossover, is at the typical length scale of the separation of the vortices. So this is another open question. So I'm come to conclusions.
Well,
it's just impedance matching. The energy which comes down from the three-dimensional cascade cannot really proceed neatly into a one-dimensional cascade of individual vortices. There is a change of dimensionality which takes place between the two cascades also. Actually, it turns out to be minus 5/3. But from the point of view of the Kelvin-Wave cascade, one should distinguish between the three-dimensional energy spectrum, which I'm plotting here, and the one-dimensional energy spectrum, which I'm considering here, because the cascade is one-dimensional. So the actual interesting spectrum is not the 3D spectrum, but it's the 1D spectrum. And the numerical models, both numerical models, which are very different, Euler dynamics and Gross-Peterski, now agree with the prediction of the power law for the amplitudes. And therefore, we can put it on that graph. So I want to come to conclusions now, because it's getting late. So why quantum turbulence? I think it is an interesting phenomenon per se. There are also issues which I did not touch. I sort of mentioned the vortex dynamics aspects, which interest me more. And they are really old aspects, still unsolved, dating back to Lord Kelvin. There are issues of phase transitions, like the Kibble-Zurek mechanism. There is the problem of the relation between quantum turbulence and classical turbulence. Now, my inclination at this stage is to say that with quantum turbulence, we see the skeleton of turbulence. We see the skeleton of the fundamentals of a very important phenomenon, which is turbulence. And we see it better because the vorticity is discrete. It is quantized. So the good question is, do we really see that classical behavior emerges from the presence of many quanta of circulation, I mean? Yes, we do. We see the Kolmogorov spectrum emerging from this mass of vortices, provided we look at sufficiently large length scales. However, there are counterexamples in which we don't see the emergence of classical behavior, and I'm puzzled by that. Then there is the issue of topology. I think this is the best context where to study the topology of turbulence, because it's a problem which is well defined. It's very difficult to trace a vortex line in a classical fluid, because you have to do it numerically. And you hope that after computing the vorticity going around the twisted loops, you come back together to satisfy the solenoidal condition. So that is actually very difficult to expect. So there is a challenge experimentally, particularly the flow visualization, but progress in the last few years has been terrific. So I finished. I just want to mention that if you want to know more about quantum turbulence, in the issue of March of PNAS, there is a collection of articles which I edited together with Srinivasan and Skrebek, which give you really the state of the arts of the problem. And I thank you very much. Two-dimensional. Well, two-dimensional turbulence is very different. Even in classical fluid mechanics, things are very different. And really, what is the main difference is, the main difference is that we don't have this cascade, this direct cascade from the large length scales to the small length scales. Two-dimensional flows are typically produced by stratification or rotation. So they're important in the context of geophysics or planetary science. So the rotation, as you know, will tend to align the flow along the axis of rotation. There, the major prediction is the inverse cascade. That is to say, energy flows from the high wave numbers to the small wave numbers, the other way around. And rather than breaking eddies, like Russ has showed you, he showed a cartoon in which eddies were breaking up into smaller and smaller eddies. Rather than that effect, in two dimensions, we see that eddies merge. And we end up creating large-scale phenomena like Jupiter's red spot. So is that true also in a quantum fluid? Well, some people, there are recent papers published this year, last year, they say yes. In experiments with two-dimensional, quasi-two-dimensional Bose-Einstein condensates, in numerical simulations, they claim they have seen this inverse cascade. Okay. The difference, however, is not trivial, because the idea of the inverse cascade in 2D arises from the presence of a second quadratic invariant, which is the energy. The energy is the first. The second quadratic invariant, which is the entropy, which lacks in 3D. In 3D, the second quadratic invariant is the helicity, which is not a defined sign. Now, in the context of quantum fluids, we don't know what is the entropy because the vorticity is zero. We have vortices without vorticity. So you may say, well, do we conserve the number of vortices at least? Well, we don't even do that because reconnections in 2D become destructions of vortices. So theoretically, the situation is confused. So very open, yes?
In this reconnection event, is there some nice statement about the energy flux, the amount of energy radiated?
Yeah, we can actually compute the energy which is released by reconnection. We did it by numerical experiments. I think I can show you actually where it arises. This is very well seen by the Gross-Peterski equation, which is written there. It's a nonlinear Schrödinger equation. It's like Schrödinger equation with a cubic nonlinearity caused by the interaction between the bosons. Now, you can easily turn this equation into classical fluid mechanics. You recover the continuity equation and the Navier-Stokes equation, the Euler equation. Okay, but it is not precisely the Euler equation. This term comes out and it is extra. Okay, without this, I would have Euler. So the question is, what does it do? This term does the reconnections. This term actually is fantastic because it regularizes the Euler equation, which in general is actually mathematically very poorly behaved. If you have a vortex velocity field like 1 over r, then you can ask, what happens when r is equal to 0? Model breaks down. Reconnections are not possible, okay? But this term makes reconnections possible. And a nice feature is that this term becomes negligible when you go to length scales which are larger than the so-called healing length. So it's a bit like having Maxwell's daemon here. It does all the work which is interesting for you. It lets essentially vortices come together when they're very close to each other. It switches on, cuts and pastes, and we are left with a change of topology, and then it goes away nicely without bothering us. Okay? So this is. So, yeah, in fact, it is H bar in front. Okay. But I must stress that this equation, Gross-Peterski, nonlinear Schrödinger, is much better behaved than Euler, which is notorious for being difficult to solve, numerically, particularly. This equation is actually, I think, a nice way to put it from the point of view of computational physics. I would call it its regularization of Euler. But it is a fundamental equation because it describes pretty well a weakly interacting Bose-Einstein condensate.